as a theoretical tool.
We'll see a number of contexts in theoretical physics where entanglement plays an increasingly important role. But I want to start by reminding you of what we saw yesterday and going through some example that I had to rush over. So what we've seen so far, summary, is that we have ground states of local Hamiltonians, and we can look at the entanglement on those states, and we have what we call an area law, right? Meaning that if we look at a system, an infinite system, on the ground state, and we trace out most of the system, and we are left with a region of linear size L, then the entropy, entanglement entropy, on this region will scale as the size of the boundary of the region, okay? So L to the d minus 1 in these spatial dimensions, or at most there will have some logarithmic corrections, and that's about it. And I said that when do we have unstrict area law? Well, this could be for gap systems, but also for some gapless systems with a small number, a small manifold of zero modes. And when do we have a logarithmic correction? So we have a logarithmic correction when there is a d minus one dimensional manifold of zero modes. For instance, in the case of fermions, if we were in two dimensions, two spatial dimensions, and we had a one-dimensional manifold, one-dimensional Fermi surface, then we see this logarithmic correction, okay? But the point here is not whether we have a logarithmic correction or not, but that when we compare this area law to what we have in a generic or random state, where we have a volume law, then we clearly see that our ground states don't have a lot of entanglement compared to what it could be, okay? That's the summary of what we discussed. And now I want to go back to this toy model. We remember we discussed a number of toy models of wave functions that seem to reproduce the area law and also the logarithmic corrections to the area law. And specifically, I want to go back to this toy model where I said that we have a one-dimensional system. We have some region A. And now we could have entanglement through nearest neighbors. Okay. We could also have entanglement between blocks. And on top of that, when we look at the system, we make bigger blocks, we could have entanglement through these bigger blocks. And the conclusion here was that if we have contributions to entanglement to all length scale, so this is fixed. We have a region of size 8, and then we look at all the contributions to entanglement there. If we were picking up contributions from each length scale, sorry, there was two, right? One from here, one from there, two here, two here. The result was 8, which was nothing but 2 times log of the region L, log 2 of region L, okay? And that would explain a logarithmic scaling of entanglement. But now I want to consider a situation where we're going to assume that we have a finite correlation length in the system. So I'm going to assume, oops, somebody changed this. Don't do that to me. Oh, no. OK. So now we're going to assume that we have finite correlation length. And that is such that the implication is that we only get this type of entanglement and this type, but not this one. Okay? So suppose we different length scales contribute to entanglement. This one, we have single lattice spacing, double lattice spacing, but not anymore at longer distances. Okay? So that would be what we find in ground states of gap Hamiltonians. There might be several contributions corresponding to several length scales. But then we have some characteristic length scale, correlation length, after which there are no new contributions. So then let's study what would happen in this case if we look at entanglement as a function of L. So now we're going to change the size of the region. First, we start with the region L equal to 2. Then we'll look at L equal to 4. And finally, L equal to 8. And what we find is that in this case, for L equal to 2, we have this contribution to entanglement. So we would conclude that entanglement for L equal to 2 is equal to 1 plus 1, so 2. Okay. The entanglement when we have a bigger block, region A, L4, we would have short-range entanglement, and then this contribution as well. So short-range entanglement and this contribution. And so the entanglement in the case where the region A has four sides would be addition of two contributions corresponding to the shortest length scale and the next length scale in the system. But now if we look at larger systems, larger regions, L equal to 8, what we find is that, again, we have the contribution from the shortest distance, then the contribution from the next distance. But we said this is it, right? We said that we don't consider the next contribution. So that means that for S L equal to 8, we still only have 2 plus 2. Okay? So we're saturated at 4. Okay? So what I'm saying is that this would be the first point for L equal to 2. This is the second point, but now we are set. Sorry, the second point would be here, and now we're saturated. Okay? So from now on, doesn't matter how large our region A is, how many sides we have in here, all the contributions that we get to the entanglement for this region are for the shortest distance and the next distance. Okay? There is nothing else. So what we see is a transition from this logarithmic scaling to a constant. Okay? Is that clear? Any question?
Could we not have correlation between different length scales?
Could we have correlations between?
Yeah, so could we have like a L equals 4 block correlated with it?
Okay, not in this time model. I define this time model as just giving you correlations between blocks of the same size. But I'm saying this simple time model already is compatible with this type of.
Okay, so the idea is something simple to make that
plot. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So the next time you see a plot like this, you say, okay, that could be explained in this simple way, where you have that your many degrees of freedom are entangled at short distances, at longer distances, but not at even longer distances. And so the critical system, the ground state for the gapless Hamiltonian, would correspond to the case where you have contributions from all length scales, right? So we would continue this logarithmic scaling. And if there is some finite correlation length, you can think, OK, from that length on, there is no entanglement in the system. OK, very good. So today, we want to talk about entanglement as a theoretical tool. So that's going to be lecture 13, theory. What did I say? Entanglement. As a theoretical tool. And then 13.1. We'll start with entanglement entropy. Entropy, so probably I'll be writing EE from now on, and universality. Okay, and this is going to be just a discussion. So what I just summarized before is that if we have a Hamiltonian, which is local in the space dimensions, then we keep claiming that there is an area law for the ground state. Okay. And this could be also corrected with this logarithmic correctness. And this happens to, or we claim that this is lattice also, we can see this on the lattice, we can see this in quantum field theories, exactly solid models, whatever we throw at it, the answer is always that there is an areola. So what's happening? Really, do we understand this? And the fact is that people intuitively, you know, I just gave you some time models, and you could understand that maybe there is some that whatever this is compatible with previous knowledge about ground states, namely that the correlations decay with distance on the ground state. And if you have power law decay of correlations, then the way the correlations decay is much slower than if you have an exponential decay. If you have an exponential decay, you could think, OK, entanglement is only short distance contributions, okay, and that would give you an area law. So we played around with time models already. But what I want to focus here is on the fact that this is very universal. Okay? So we're saying, give me any local Hamiltonian. I don't need to know what type of physics you're trying to describe. So there could be ferromagnetism, antiferromagnetism, topological order. It doesn't matter. It turns out that this you expect that to happen. So qualitatively, at least, this is true of all ground states. And you can think of that as hinting at a very fundamental truth of nature. I mean, you know, these are big words, but I think this applies here. So this is something that we only in the last, say, 10 years, we started to understand and exploit. Okay? It's some knowledge that is useful knowledge. It's not just, oh, you know, this is green. No, what can we do with that, right? So now that we understand this, there are lots of things that we can do. And of course, I'll be talking about this for the rest of the course. But here's an observation. In quantum mechanics, what we have is that, you know, there are postulates. And one of them says, we have a vector space of states. We call it Hilbert space. Then we have Hermitian operators corresponding to observables, blah, blah, blah. Okay, it's a postulate. Another postulate says that if you have a composite system, then it's described by a vector space, which is a tensor product of each of the vector spaces for each of the parts. Okay. And now you apply this to n parts, okay, and you get this huge Hilbert space. And we're still following the basic postulates of quantum mechanics. But here's a new observation. Most of the content of this huge Hilbert space is useless, okay, to real physics. So, you know, you can follow mathematics. If we just summarize the summary, the postulates that we went quickly through, in principle, any linear superposition of states in this Hilbert space is a physical state. Okay? But in practice, that's not true, in the sense that we don't find them. And we don't find them in nature because it's not possible from a computational perspective, from a computer science perspective. Right? You would think, what's the complexity of getting to this superposition? And it turns out that, well, you would need to deal with exponentially many parameters. There is not a problem of how do I put this in my laptop. Okay? It's a problem of how long would it take it to nature to prepare certain linear superposition given local Hamiltonian, right? That's what we find in nature. Nature is governed by local Hamiltonians. And you could ask, if we start with spins in a product state, what's the time that it would take for an arbitrary local Hamiltonian, which can depend on time and so on, okay, but with bounded strength, how long would it take for nature or for this evolution to be able to prepare such a linear combination? And you pick up randomly a state in the Hilbert space, okay, of n spins for n large, and you realize that it would take nature to prepare that longer than the age of the universe. Okay, so that is telling you something deep. Telling you that this framework that we take for granted, which is take the tensor product of local Hilbert spaces, that this huge Hilbert space is actually too large. There is nothing wrong with it. It contains a lot of states which are not relevant to physics. They are not relevant to nature. Okay? So it's an overcomplete description, if you want. You have too much in there. Okay? So what we're going to do now is, what entanglement has, this is a conclusion that we, you know, it was always there. You don't need entanglement to argue this. I just counted parameters, right? Local Hamiltonians depend on a number of parameters, which is only proportional to the system size because, you know, let's say it's nearest neighbors suppose your local Hamiltonian is coupling, if you have and sides, imagine your local Hamiltonian is sum of terms that couples any pair, right? So then if you have n sides, you have how many Hamiltonian terms? Well, you have here at most n square terms, okay? Each term, so hij, right? You have n square terms in the Hamiltonian. Each Hamiltonian term may depend on, I don't know, 16 parameters, whatever, okay? Some order one parameter, okay? So now what we want to understand, even if we change these parameters in time, we want to understand how long does it take to create an arbitrary state of that depends on 2 to the n. And there is no, you know, this has no fighting chance, right? It's exponential versus quadratic. So for large n, it will take exponential long time to get to some particular. So I'm saying let's choose randomly some state, okay, random. Let's choose it. That's 2 to the n coefficient. And now let's try to obtain it through a local evolution starting from a product state. Okay. So the idea is that if you do that with a Hamiltonian of this form, which may depend on time, and the only restriction we have here is that the strength of these couplings have to be finite. Okay, we fixed the at most the strength. You know, you cannot put infinite energy. You cannot have an arbitrarily fast evolution. So if we put the finite strength on these couplings, then when you try to evolve this through the Schrödinger equation, okay, we would have to put, well, if the Hamiltonian was constant, then we would write something like this. If not, we would write something a bit more complicated. Then what you realize is that this t has to be exponential in n. Okay? And therefore, you know, for sufficiently large n, such state is not relevant to physics because it would take longer than the age of the universe for nature to prepare that state. So as a matter of fact, this affects to almost the full Hilbert space for large n. So the Hilbert space is a highly redundant description of the, it's the setting where the physical states live, but most of the states in the Hilbert space are not physical. Okay? Okay, so I went a bit dramatic here with big words, but it's true that we are learning something important about physics. We don't have a postulate yet in quantum mechanics that incorporates this, but maybe we don't need to wait for someone to give us a postulate. The basic idea is clear. Okay? This tensor product structure has the problem that produces an exponentially large Hilbert space, and the states we care about live there, but most of the states that live there are not relevant to us. Okay, so that was some generic, some qualitative discussion. Now, so this would be a particular expression. I'm not saying that the only states that we care about the Hilbert space fulfill the area law. Okay, we can have evolution of, you know, we can take our quantum system starting, say, from the ground state. We can perturb it, evolve it in time, and we can go away from this area law. Okay? But still, we will still only be able to explore a sub-manifold in the full Hilbert space. So I want to go back to ground states now. And for these ground states, I want to say that not only this is describing this area law is universal in the sense that it applies to all ground states, but we can also go quantitatively. And see that there is also different notions of, there are notions of universality both for phases and for phase transitions, and that the entanglement entropy provides information on the universality class. Of the renormalization group fixed points. Okay? So we're going to discuss this with two examples. Or actually, we're going to be talking about gap phases. So there are two types of fixed points that we're going to discuss, those corresponding to gap phases or stable fixed points, and also to phase transitions. Yeah?
Your font went down again.
Went down?
Yeah.
Have to write bigger?
Yes.
OK, thank you. I should do it, huh? Well, OK. Gap phases, phase transitions, and now bigger. Anion models. So I want to discuss these two examples, or equivalently, topological quantum field theories. And for phase transitions, we'll have these critical lattice models or conformal field theories. Okay. So what we want to see next is that by just looking at the scaling of entanglement entropy, we're able to extract information from the many-body system, information that tells us about, for gap phases, it will tell us about what anion model we are in, and this anion model in 2 plus 1 dimensions, which has a topological quantum field theory description in the continuum. This anion model defines the universal properties of that gap phase. And for phase transitions, we will, or quantum field theories, we will see, we have already been seeing that entanglement entropy will also give us information about what's the CFT. Okay? So the picture there is that if in the space of theories, space of, so let's say Hamiltonian, in the space of couplings for the Hamiltonian, right? We may have many couplings, and I can only draw two or three directions here, but we'll have some notion of RG flow. And what we will find then is that this RG flow will split this space into pieces. And maybe from this piece, from this part, everything will flow to some fixed point. From that part on, everything will flow to another fixed point. You know, the typical RG picture. What I'm saying is that now we might be able to use entanglement to characterize this fixed point. Very good. So then this is 13.1 on A. Nice. I'm calling this entanglement entropy in quantum critical systems. And in secret or slice CFTs. Okay, and we've seen this. We've been discussing this for quite some time. So you want to think of the CFT as describing a universality class. In the sense that there might be many microscopic models that a criticality behave in the same way, and the CFT is this same way, this defines this same way. This conformal field theory is described by some conformal data. And this would be a list of primary fields. And then we would have the scaling dimensions that you've heard a lot about by now, the conformal spins. Etc. And this conformal data includes the central charge, okay? So C, central charge. That would be in 1 plus 1. Oh, no, in general. So actually, let me do it this way. This this is in general, and then in 1 plus 1 dimensions, conformal data includes the central charge C. And here is something that you know well by now, but I want to look at it from another perspective, which is assume we can compute the ground state of the model. Okay? And now, I'm not saying we can. In general, we don't know how to do that. Okay? It might be very challenging. But I'm not going to worry about this. I'm going to focus on the fact that this, even when we can compute the ground state, this is a huge amount of information, right? It's 2 to the n complex numbers. And so it contains lots of, well, all, in particular, this wave function may contain all the information about the conformal data. Okay? But if I give you 2 to the n complex numbers, you say, where is the conformal data, right? You may need to learn a lot about that theory before you can give me the conformal data, because all I have right now is just a very long list of complex numbers. And what's pretty amazing about entanglement entropy is that it allows us to extract the central charge without learning anything else about the theory. We don't need to know what are the operators that scale in a given way. We don't need, you know, we may not even, so somebody sends you this 2 to the n complex coefficients in an email. They don't tell you what the Hamiltonian is. You don't need to know anything, just from the wave function. Okay, what we can do is we can extract the central charge. How does this work? Well, we've been discussing it, right? Given the wave function, we compute the reduced density matrix for a region. We can compute then the entropy for attached to the region. We can plot this entropy as a function of the size L of the region in logarithmic scale. And there you are. You get some curve, which happens to be C over 3 log 2L. So we have not learned what the scaling operators of the theory are. We don't need to know the Hamiltonian anymore. We don't need to know anything. We just do something that is exactly the same that we would do for any CFT, for any ground state that they give us. And we can extract the central charge out of it. Okay? Very good. So how much did we learn if we have the central charge? Well, unfortunately, that's not everything about the CFT. The CFT is not completely characterized. In 1 plus 1 is not completely characterized by a central charge. There are all these primary fields. We would need to know maybe the scaling dimensions, conformal spins, operator product expansion coefficients. But it turns out that we are lucky that in some situations, knowing the central charge is already knowing a lot or knowing everything. So let me describe this here. So how much do we learn about the CFT in 1 plus 1 if we know the central charge? Well, for C smaller than 1, okay, there is only a discrete set of what's called unitary minimal models, minimal CFT models, with central charge 1 minus 6 over m plus 1, or m equal to 3, 4, 5, etc., infinite. And that means, actually, so the key here is unitary, which are the type of theories that we're interested in when we have a Hamiltonian and we want to find the ground state. So it turns out that if I have a lattice model, which is a Hamiltonian on the lattice, and I have that after computing entanglement entropy, I see that the scaling is, say, the one that would correspond to C 1/2. So it would be 1 over 6 log L. If I see a 1 over 6 log L scaling for the entanglement entropy, automatically I know that this is the Ising CFT. Okay. So just by looking at how entanglement scales, in the case where central charge is smaller than one, I can completely characterize the universality class. I don't need the extra conformal data because there is only one CFT with that central charge. So if C was 1/2, I get the Ising model. If it's 7/10, so I'm just going now through the different values of M here, then it will be the tricritical Ising CFT. If C is equal to 4 over 5, that will be the 3-level Potts model. Okay. There is next C equal to 6 over 7. That would be the tricritical three-state Potts model. And you know, you can go on forever. Okay? If you see a central charge that is smaller than 1, you are done. You have completely characterized the CFT. Okay? So that's quite useful. Now, for central charge not smaller than 1, the situation is very different. Or central charge equal to 1, for instance, what we have is that there are two continuous families. Of CFTs. So if I do this experiment and I get a 1/3 log L, then I actually haven't, so central charge is equal to 1. I don't know which CFT I have yet. Okay, there are many. There are infinitely many CFTs with C equal to 1. There are two continuous families, the list, and they correspond to what's called compactified boson. And they are parameterized, and I'll refer to this again later. So there is this compactified boson on a circle or a column. They are also called column models. And so there is some parameter, the compactification radius, circle, continuous parameter. For each value of this parameter, we have a different CFT. Okay? So there are, and all the scaling dimensions depend continuously on this parameter. So it just gets more complicated than for this discrete series of unitary minimal models for a central charge smaller than 1. And there is another family, which is called orbifold. The orbifold models. And again, we have some continuous parameter, which parameterizes all these different CFTs with the same central charge. So if we look at entanglement entropy, we don't get everything. Okay? We get a partial characterization only of the CFT in general. We'll see later, I'll tell you that actually, remember, entanglement entropy was a radical reduction of all the parameters we had available. We had the full entanglement spectrum. Okay? And it turns out that if we look at the entanglement spectrum, we might be able to characterize this radius, and then we would have a complete characterization, at least for C equal to 1, a complete characterization of the CFT. I'll mention this later.
Okay? Sorry, I lost track there. Compactified boson belongs to the two continuous families of CFT, or
the two continuous families
are
so
on the right.
So these continuous families are, so the free boson, you can define some boundary conditions in the boson itself. So boson is a real field, and you can decide that instead of being on the real line, the field takes values not on the real line, but you can compactify that. And there are different ways in which you can do that.
Okay.
And so these continuous families correspond to that, two different ways of doing that.
All right.
And these are the two continuous families.
Okay.
All of them are free boson in some way.
Thanks.
Any other questions?
So what you're doing, what you're saying here, is all for unitary CFTs, right?
Right.
That's a requirement for all of this. So I was wondering, can you also do all of what we did before for non-unitary ones?
Okay, so all we did before was talking about Hamiltonians.
Yes.
And ground state. Right?
Can I throw away the condition of being being Hermitian?
you can throw it away. I don't know what will happen next after that. So,
there still a sense in which you can define what the ground state
yes.
means for?
So actually, it is true that you can have non Hermitian Hamiltonians where the spectrum of low energy states is still organized according to the conformal towers. So there is at least there is partial some part of the story I've told you that could still go through, but I don't know much about that. I don't know much. And it's not, in my story, ground state of a Hermitian, of a normal Hamiltonian is what I want to emphasize. Okay, so then what else can we say about this entanglement entropy? Still for 1+1 systems, we can talk about the C theorem. And the reference here is Zamo Lotchikov. Okay. And this, we're talking about the 80s. And again, we have this picture of the space of theories and the RG flow. So maybe we have a CFT, one, we are going to call this the UV, some CFT 2 in the infrared or low energies, then we could have some flow, but of course we could also have another fixed point trivial in the infrared, and we could have then in the space of theories we could have a flow doing something like that, right? Going from one CFT to the trivial or to the trivial fixed point or through another CFT. Okay. So the idea is that the idea is to show, or what this theorem established was that there exists some function, I'm going to call C, sorry about calling C everything, but that's, you know, this theorem is known as the C theorem. I don't think I have many options there. There is some function, which is non-negative, which decreases monotonically. Along the RG flow. Okay? So that means that if sorry?
Why is it non-negative?
I don't know why it has to be non-negative, but it's non-negative. This is what the theorem says.
I mean, in 1+1 dimension, and the only condition, like the only thing that says C should be positive
No. This C, as I said, I'm calling C some function.
Yes, but that's, okay. In 1+1 dimension, that is the common C.
Maybe. Okay. So. I'm reading what a work of other people, right? So I don't know. They decided that there was some function that was positive, and so let's parameterize as by mu the flow in the RG flow, and so then the statement is that this quantity has a derivative along the RG flow with well-defined sign, only going down. And such that, and C mu at an RG fixed point is the central term. Okay, so when we reach a fixed point, this is the C that we were discussing before. The central charge of the corresponding CFD. Okay, so this was a very influential piece of work because it tells us that that when you change the scale, okay, when we flow in the sense of the RG flow, when we look at lower and lower energies, at least for relativistic theories, you cannot go back to the theory you started from, right? Either you are in a fixed point, nothing happens, so either you see the same theory all the time, or if you see a change in the theory, if your theory is changing, it means it cannot go back as you go to lower energies. You cannot do something like start here and after a while you're back. Okay? Because in the sense that as soon as the central charge is reduced a little bit, it shows that the energy flow is irreversible. Okay, so what's interesting is that Cassini and Huerta in 2006 showed that this function, as provided by Zamolodchikov, was a specific function that required knowledge of the stress tensor. It requires some knowledge of the theory. And what Cassini Huerta showed was that actually you can define a function that fulfills these properties, which was not the original function, but fulfills the same properties, as given just by L, so as a function of this size, 3L ds of L dl. If you look at the entanglement entropy, okay, if you look at the entanglement entropy of a region of size L, as a function of the size of the region L, if you take the derivative, so we're going to have to go to the continuum, or maybe this is on the lattice, this could be a finite difference. Then if you take this derivative and multiply it by L again, then you get a function that fulfills these properties, that has monotonic behavior under the RG flow. Okay? So it's a C function. And the way this is proven only requires, so proof requires, it's a very simple proof, and it requires strong sub-additivity, of the entanglement entropy. This is a property that the entanglement entropy fulfills, so it's not an assumption. It just, this says that the entropy of regions of three parts ABC minus or plus the entropy of just part B is not greater than the entropy of AB plus the entropy of BC. And now I need to check that because, so the proof requires strong subadditivity. It requires Lorentz invariance. And unitary. Okay. So this is not a requirement. It's just an element that appears in the proof. But this is a property of the entanglement entropy. And this and what this says is that the result applies only to a certain type of theory, which is just relativistic theories, the type of theories we usually care about. OK, and so what we learn with this is that, or if you want, this is very nice because it says that that an important result that require some sophisticated proof, et cetera, can be replaced with a new C function with a very simple proof, okay? And which only requires looking at entanglement again, okay? This function is just defined in terms of the entanglement entropy. Okay. And actually, you could check what happens for the case where the entropy is that of a fixed point, or a CFT. Okay. And what you can see here is that if we take the derivative of this, we get 1 over L, C over 3. Times 3 times L. So in this case, right, for a CFT, we indeed get that this is equal to C. Okay? It's looking good. This function has the right property. Okay? Did I do something wrong here?
No, I'm just wondering, C of L is still a function of L, not just of your field theory. So Or is your statement that C of L is such a function for all L? Or? I mean, the logic of C function is a function from QFDs to R.
Oh, I see. Wait a second. Yes. It's more complicated than that. No. You're absolutely right. So there is a layer of complexity here, which I would love to ignore, but I guess now I have to answer your comment. So it turns out that what does it mean to have a function from a QFD to a number? What's this function, right? So the QFT is not well defined until you give me a regularization scheme, and then we'll know. You know, until you don't give me some epsilon and so on, right? Okay. So this is all hidden here. We just put it on the lattice as a way of regularizing the theory. That's why we, and there should be otherwise. This expression here comes with an epsilon that has to be. So there is a, you know, there is a complicated story. But what I'm trying to say in the end is that is the following. So let's take it. Let's just take some cartoonish picture out of this, and it would be the following: that we could have the XX model as one of the CFTs. This is the same as the free fermion model that we've been discussing. So this would be that one where we had AM dagger AM plus one plus Hermitian conjugate. Okay, in terms of fermionic variables. Okay, this is a Hamiltonian that you've been analyzing, and it turns out to be equivalent to a model in spin variables, which is sigma x plus sigma y for nearest neighbors. So this would be spins. Okay, so there is a model that I'm going to call xx, which happens to correspond to a CFT with central charge equal to 1, and that's what you saw. The scaling of Van-Tamman entropy for the free fermion had this C equal to 1, well, 1 over 3 log L scaling. There is another theory here, which is another CFT with C equal to 1 half, which is the IZ model. Well, it turns out that what we could do, so the IZ model, meaning sigma x plus sigma z, okay? In spin variable. Otherwise, I can also write it in terms of Majorana, quadratic Majorana Hamiltonian. The important thing is this is a theory right there. It's the Ising CFT. We also have the XX model CFT, okay? That you can put in your computer because you've been analyzing both already, okay? And now you could ask, it turns out that, well, there is a Hamiltonian that interpolates between these two. I'm going to write it here. It's called the XY Hamiltonian. It's a spin Hamiltonian, and it reads, what is it? HXY is equal to minus, I'm going to write 1 plus some gamma over 2, sigma x, plus 1 minus gamma over 2 sigma y, okay? And then there is some magnetic field that depends on gamma, sigma z. So I get this Hamiltonian, okay? For gamma equal to 1, and assuming that this magnetic field goes away, we get the XX Hamiltonian, which is our free fermion model. Okay? For gamma equal to 0, no, you shouldn't let me say this thing. So for gamma equal to 1, we get the IZ model. For gamma equal to 0, we get the XX model. So this Hamiltonian interpolates between these two. Okay? And what we could do is the following experiment. We could start with this Hamiltonian, the XX model. Okay? And instead of having so XX model, as I said, is gamma equal to 0. Now we could put the XY model for gamma very, very small, okay? So that's very close to the first CFT, okay? But it turns out that it's very close, but this gamma introduces some relevant perturbation that will force this flow into the IZ model, okay? So what will happen, what's going to happen if we plot now the entanglement entropy for this model. So again, the model is the free fermion that you've been studying, or XX model, with a little perturbation that I claim that flows to the, makes it flow to the Ising model. So what's going to happen is that we will see a scaling of entanglement entropy that is logarithmic, then some transitional behavior, and then a new straight line, which also corresponds to logarithmic scaling. So this is going to go from 1 over 3 log L to 1 over 6 log L. Okay. This is an experiment you can do. You have your code ready there. Okay. You can look at entanglement entropy.
This is not a critical system. And for non-critical systems, didn't you claim that?
It is a critical system. Which part is not critical?
The XY model. For all, you're claiming that the XY model is critical for all?
There is
gamma?
For all gamma within the range of from 0 to 1, there is a choice of magnetic field for which this is a critical system.
So you have a line of CFTs.
It's actually the same CFT. It's a CFT. So it's the initial point is of CFT and the final point is of CFT. And anything along this line is flowing to that CFT. Right? So it's always, there is a CFT.
On the line itself, they're QFTs, they're not CFTs.
That's true, but they are critical in the sense that there is power law decay of correlations. We never have a gap. System is always gap.
So it's a CFT which is not a CFT.
It's not scale invariant because there are irrelevant operators in the Hamiltonian that need to be washed away. So as you change scale, you see that physics is changing, it's approaching a new fixed point. This is the meaning of this line here. This line here was critical all the time. It was flowing from one CFT, C1, CFT1 to CFT2. So you have a transition, for instance, in terms of entanglement entropy, from one logarithmic scaling into a new logarithmic scaling. And what I'm saying is that this function here, this function, has the value 1, and then eventually, so it's a derivative, right? So it's or proportional to the derivative, has some value 1, and it's asymptotically approaching 1/2. So in between, it will go from 1 to 1/2, okay? But monotonically. So this quantity here will flow from 1 to 1/2 along this flow. Along this, as we consider larger and larger systems.
So there are systems that are neither critical nor not critical.
No, I said they are critical.
I mean, critical means scale invariant.
No, it means that it flows to a scale invariant situation. In a critical system is characterized by an RG fixed point, but you don't need to be in the RG fixed point, right? So if you have a situation like this. So this is our CFT, sits here. Okay? If you are in this point and you look at the flow, it stays here. But if you are here, if the couplings of your theory say that you are here, this is, remember, a space of coupling, then if you change scale, things are changing, your couplings are changing, but they're flowing towards a place where they will stop changing. So scale invariance is at this point, but this system is, so when you are not at the scale, the fixed point of the RG flow, but you are in a trajectory that is leading to a fixed point of the RG flow, what that means is that you have that the physics depend on scale, but for sufficiently low energies, they stop depending on scale. Okay? So you can have a critical system that is not scale invariant. It's flowing to a scale invariant system. Very good. Okay. I don't mind questions. I actually think questions are very good, but there are implications. And the implications is that I'm going to skip topological order. But that's OK. I'm just going to reiterate what I said before, that remember that the entropy, I have 2 minutes, so I'm going to use them to say in 2 plus 1 and in 3 plus 1 dimensions, the entanglement entropy can also be used. There are to characterize irreversibility of the RG flow. The results, the expressions are different. It's not known as, it's not a C theorem, but an F theorem. Rob Myers here at PI has contributed very importantly to this topic. So you go ask him. And then I wanted to talk about topological order, but I think it's OK if we don't do that. And then finally, I wanted to tell you that all this discussion had only entanglement entropy in its center. But as I said, entanglement entropy was only giving us the central charge. Okay, turns out that then we had many CFTs with the same central charge. Now, if we go back to our we'll go back to thinking about the entanglement spectrum. So remember that that means we have the ground state, we split it into two pieces, and we have this type of decomposition. Okay. So if we look at these eigenvalues, the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix, turns out that at criticality, they are also organized in a universal way. We can also extract information from these values. And for instance, in the case of a 1 plus 1 dimensional system, if we look at the cat, this is A. This is A complement. So these are our sites. If we look at the spectrum attached to this cat, okay, then by this spectrum has to do, again, is organized according to the scaling dimensions. Right? So from here, we might be able to extract information about the scaling dimensions of the theory. Okay? And that has been used to characterize what CFT you are getting. So first you look at this entanglement entropy. You say, OK, C equal to 1. Now, a more refined question is what C equal to 1 CFT you have. And you can do that by identifying a pattern, a pattern that appears in the entanglement spectrum. Very good. Okay, so then it's time for me to finish. So I want to summarize by saying that as far as entanglement is concerned, we've been looking at bipartite entanglement. We've looked at entanglement entropy. We've looked at the Schmidt coefficients. We've learned that many body ground states obey this area law, which we have learned to interpret through a simple toy model as saying that entanglement is mostly short distance in ground state. And we've learned that we can use entanglement as a diagnose for quantum criticality. We haven't seen that also for topological order. And so what I want to do, starting from tomorrow morning, is to now go and see how to exploit this structure. We've identified some structure in the entanglement of ground states. And what we want to do from now on is to understand how to exploit it to build representations, efficient representations of ground states. Okay? We'll be able to build approximate representations of a ground state that instead of taking 2 to the n parameters, will take order n parameters. We will start tomorrow. I think tomorrow is going to be spectacular because we have 2 lectures and a tutorial. That means 3.5 hours of tensor networks. So yeah, if you want to get sick, tomorrow is a good day. Other than that, I'll see you tomorrow.